An interview with Tony Turlato, chairman of Turlato Wines International, could fill an entire day's worth of recording in order for him to tell his story. Anthony Turlato operates his worldwide company from a 27-room Tudor Gothic mansion located in Lake Bluff, Illinois. Just a few of his labels include Chimney Rock, Rutherford Hill, Santa Margarita, Two Hands, and many, many more. When it comes to wine, and especially Turlato, hospitality is king. And my visit was one to remember. Today, we're here with Tony Turlato. Tony, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for coming down in the snow.
It's a beautiful day outside the window, as long as you're looking outside the window and not in the car. Uh-huh. I guess the first thing I want to focus on, which has been a focus of Life Between the Vines, is family. And to me, Turlato is all about family. Tell me how that started for you in terms of a business.
I worked with my father. My father had one of the first self-service retail stores in Chicago, supermarket style with baskets. And he was retired. He had been in the insurance business. And he didn't enjoy retirement so much. He felt he was too young. So he decided to open a retail liquor and wine shop. I was living in Florida at the time, and he asked me to come back to Chicago and give him some help to open the store, and I did. And I just fell in love with the wine part of it. He had a 100-foot wall of wine all laying down, and those were the days when people would open liquor stores, and I was a salesman. I would ask, where's the wine section going to be? And people said, I haven't decided yet. And those were the customers that I really enjoyed talking to, because they made me have to do a study about wine. They would come in, we had so much wine, and they would ask, well, what's the difference between, you know, Chateau Talbot and Chateau Bechevel, and, you know, what's the difference between this and that? Well, so I had to educate myself on it. So I started to read a lot, and the reading led to tastings. And I had to learn, could I identify wines with breed? Because that's what I called it, the difference between an inexpensive wine and an expensive wine. So I would take home two bottles of wine every night for dinner when I went home. One that was, in those days, there was California wines that were 49 cents a bottle. And Chateau Rarasan Gassis 1959 was $3.98 a bottle. And my wife would pour one in each glass. I wouldn't know what it is. And I would taste them both. And then after about 3 or 4 or 5 months, I was able to, sometimes just with the aromas, would be able to identify which was the more expensive wine. And I realized the only way to learn that is to read about them, and then keep doing blind tastings. And then from there, all the rest of my life has been blind tastings. And even my father said to me, there'll come times people put a glass in front of you and say, tell me what this is. Well, at that time, there was 40,000 wines in the United States. Now there's 130,000. He said, you're never going to be able to pick it. Just determine how much you'd be willing to pay for it. He says, and that's how you should identify it. So what I learned to do was try to identify, how good is this wine? How important is it? What are the aromas? You know, is there a grape varietal that shows through? Is the wine clean, et cetera? And, you know, try to identify, is it a young wine or an older wine, which is easy to do by the color. And I learned that by doing this, that I became quite knowledgeable about wines, and people depended on me for advice of what wines to buy. And then I married a girl whose father was a wine bottler, and so my education continued on through. We spent our honeymoon in Napa Valley, part of it, and with Robert Mondavi. But that was 1955, and nobody at that time knew who Robert Mondavi was, because he became famous in 1967, 1968. So I knew Bob when he wasn't very famous, and we became very close friends because he saw the interest that I had in learning about wine. I would just kind of hang on every word that he would say, and he would say things like, someday, Tony, it's going to be like Europe here. You're going to go in a restaurant, there's going to be a bottle of wine on every table. Now, when you said that in 1956 or 1957, you know, people were still drinking gallons for 99 cents a gallon. And there was, you know, people didn't swirl and smell and taste. But if you migrated to the United States and your family drank wine in Italy or wherever you came from, you just carried that over. But you weren't drinking Lafite and Mouton Rothschild, and you weren't going to stores and trying to identify vintages. And there was very few stores, actually, that had big wine sections that offered a number of different Burgundies from different regions, a number of different Bordeaux from different regions. So it was a wonderful time for me, you know, hopefully staying ahead of the curve, and I could answer all the questions.
From what I see, the wineries that you own, I get this impression that there's this almost really doing their own thing under your guidance. Am I right in that?
I agree with you. What I try to do is, I'm not a winemaker. I'm not going to try to compare myself, but there are a number of great brands that are managed. I know there's one famous winery owner who says, I'm not a winemaker, but I know enough about wine, finance, and marketing to make my brand very important, and that's Angelo Gaia. Now, I'm not trying to compare myself to him, but I'm not a winemaker. But I have to be able to identify somebody that he and I can be on the same page. So I can say to him, one of my favorite whites is Corton Charlemagne from Bon de Matre, and one of my favorite red Burgundies is Torte de Chaux, Clos de Bèze, Chambertin Clos de Bèze. And so now I'm communicating with him, and he's understanding. And if he, as a winemaker, hasn't tasted these wines, we're going to taste them together. And a lot of the wines that we're making today, I've tasted together with our head winemaker, because once a month they come here to Chicago, and we have a meeting once a month, the first Monday of every month. And the night before, I do dinner at my house, and I tell him, go in the cellar, pick out whatever you want. And he'll go down and sell, or he'll pick out whatever he wants, and then I'll bring up another one, and we'll talk about them. And one night, he went down, and he brought up Obreon. It was Doug Fletcher that was the winemaker at Chimney Rock. And I said, great. And then I brought up a bottle of Obreon Blanc, which is even more expensive than Obreon. We tasted the Obreon, and we tasted the Obreon Blanc. I said, we have Élevage. Make me Élevage Blanc, and make me a wine similar to Obreon Blanc. And he says, oh, my. And, you know, Sauvignon Blanc is easy, but Semillon is not so easy to find, but let me work on it. And he worked on it for about 2 years. He came here one month and brought me a bottle, and he said, taste this, see how you like it. And I said, oh, my, you know, this is wonderful. So the next day when we had the meeting, he had brought, I think, about three bottles. I bought a bottle of Obreon Blanc, and we used this Élevage Blanc from Chimney Rock. We tasted it blind in the meeting. And now we're talking about a $3.98 bottle of wine, and what is now probably $400 a bottle. Now, I'm not going to say that we were Obreon Blanc, but the step towards the direction of making a wine similar in a white Bordeaux that could be so important, and the wine did prove now to be very important. That's the way I'll taste white Burgundy. I'll taste Corton Charlemagne with the winemaker at Sanford and say, this is my idea of Chardonnay. So I'd like you to be tasting French Burgundies, French white Burgundies, when you're thinking about making your Chardonnays, because this is the direction I want to go in. So if I find a talented winemaker, I can kind of lead him in the direction that I want to go. Anybody, you know, a winemaker can make a Chardonnay maybe the way he wants to make it or the way his interpretation is. So he tastes all the Chardonnays from his area. You know, that's like a winemaker in Sicily tasting all the wines in his area and then saying, I'm making a great wine. Well, maybe you're making it for this area of Sicily, but how does this stand on the world table? And so I try to get the winemakers to go outside of the area and taste what is perceived or recognized or accepted to be the great wines of the world. So if you're going to make a Cabernet Sauvignon, taste Mouton and taste Lynchbage and taste Pichon. All right, now use these as your criteria. The winery next door is not the way I look at making greatness. Okay, greatness has to be something that be on the table with the great wines from all over the world, wherever they come from. So making a good Napa Valley Cabernet is not enough. It has to be a Cabernet that can stand on the world table.
Obviously, your example of education is important to you with your winemakers.
Yes.
And you want to educate them, but you still want to have them find their own style. So they do get a certain degree of...
Exactly. What I try to do is lead them in the direction. Being a winery owner, I can lead them in the direction. And obviously, I have to be able to engage winemakers to work for us that will adopt the principles that I want to put. When the winemaker today at Sanford, Steve Fennell, last year, I sent him to France, together with Doug Fletcher, the head winemaker, to Chanson, and to spend a week in Burgundy, tasting, studying the clones, the rootstocks that they're using, the clones, spending times with Gilles de Crissel, tasting white Burgundies, and then coming back. And I didn't have to say I mean, I didn't send them to Portugal. I sent them to France. I sent them to Burgundy. I sent them to one of the great Burgundy houses. And he understood. And now, is that going to reflect in his wines in the next few years? Oh, it's already reflecting in his Chardonnay. Okay? I mean, this vintage of his Chardonnay that, you know, the first that we've tasted from it, he said, do you sense something? I said, well, you know, I've been tasting wines out of bottle for a long time. You know, you've been tasting them out of barrels. I said, I have to get used to that. But let's see in a year from now. But you could see that all of the wines that we're going to be making is going to be with the influence that I have of what I perceive as being great wines.
Can I make wine for you?
Oh, sure. You know, that's what somebody said. Oh, he says, you force them to drink all those classified Bordeaux and Grand Cru Burgundies. I said, yes, I do. They really have to suffer through that. They said, oh, sure. Well, you know what I learned, because sometimes we think things that are not accurate. When I went to Bordeaux in 1970, we had a small winery in Italy at that time in Florence, in Tuscany. We made a small Chianti. It was 1972, so I brought back 70 Bordeaux. Now, the winemaker we had was a maestro assaggiatore, which means master taster. There was only 7 in all of Italy, okay? He had never tasted French Bordeaux. He had tasted Barolos and Barbarescos. He had tasted wines made from Nebbiolo. He had tasted wines from Sicily. He had tasted wines from Naples. He had tasted wines from other areas, Piedmont and so on. He had never tasted Grand Cru Bordeaux. It was a revelation to him when he tasted it, because I could see his eyes when he saw the perfumes, the aromas of the wines, and he tasted them. He saw something that he had never experienced before. Now, did we make better Chianti because of it? Yes.
I want to go back to the family aspect. Okay. Now, you talked about starting with your dad. How do your sons enter into your company?
Like I said, Robert Mondavi, nobody even knew who he was. So neither did anybody know who Alexis Lachine was, or Frank Schoonmaker, or Vittorio Gancia. But they'd come to my house, and we would have dinner, and they'd shoot baskets with my sons in the backyard. And, you know, I have pictures. So they grew up knowing these winemakers, and as they, of course, in my way of doing things, I have a great relationship with my 2 sons. So I told them, you can't come to work, you know, together with me, because I don't want to spoil this wonderful relationship. So get yourself a degree, and then, you know, go about doing what you should be doing, because I want to keep our relationship. Of course, that wasn't true. I had seen sons go through school, sons of friends of mine, knowing that they had a job, there was a company waiting, so they kind of slid through. I didn't want that to happen to the boys. So I told them, you're going to have to do something on your own. And then Billy was a senior, and Johnny was a junior, because they're only 13 months apart. And at Thanksgiving dinner one day, they said, Dad, you know what you told us, and we'll get our degrees, but we both want you to know that we want to come to work with you, and we'll take our chances. It was the happiest day of my life when they said, because I wanted them to do it. I didn't want them to come into the company and have everybody say, well, sure, he brings his sons in and, you know, he makes it easy for them. And I gave them the most difficult work to do. They had to be in the office before me, and they had to leave after me. I gave my son Billy the worst route. He started as a salesman, and I gave him the worst route in the company. He had to drive about 40 miles to get to his territory, because we lived in Chicago, and he had to drive to the northern tip of Illinois. And that was his turn. And everybody thought I'd give him downtown with Eddie Bragno and Arminetti and all the top stores, Foremost Liquors at that time. I gave him the worst territory in the company. But what I did was it made them respect him, because he made the territory important. So he himself has earned their respect. And Johnny done the same thing. Johnny continued, went to law school, became a lawyer. After he became a lawyer, never practiced law, came to work here. He can be a lawyer anytime he wants to be. So I've had now the pleasure of them being with me for over 25 years.
How old are your sons now?
Billy is 50 this year, and Johnny's 49.
Can you tell me what they handle specifically?
We had distributing companies. We had 5 distributing companies. Johnny ran all the distributing companies, and Billy managed to run the import company. One, we sold the distributorships, because that's when we started to buy wineries. So we couldn't have distributorships, importing company, winery. Winery was too much. We were crisscrossing with our own network of distributors, and I needed to stop that. So we decided we were going to be winemakers, so we sold our distributorships. And then Johnny came here, and he's handling international, and he's handling all the hiring of our personnel, which is very important to us. because we work at a particular level. So, and Johnny spends maybe a day or two before we hire somebody for an important position. And he manages our international. We have 42 distributorships around the world now.
I can see it would make you very, very proud having your sons working for you.
It's terrific.
So to go beyond that, do they have kids at all? Either
one? Oh, yes.
And?
Billy has 3 children. The girl is 24. She graduated from Duke. She went into the Teach for America program, and she's out of that now. She's going to start working for Southern Wine and Spirits January 2nd, I think. My grandson, Tony, goes to Duke as well. He's a junior now. We're talking, in fact, the other day, he's probably going to go to law school. And after law school, now he's worked in the wineries in summer. He's worked in France at Chapoutier. So is my granddaughter. I didn't tell them they had to come here, but I gave them some work to do to hope that they get to like it. And his little girl will be starting college next year. And Johnny got married much later. Got married when he was in his 30s. So he has an 8-year-old, 7-year-old, and 2-year-old. Jack, who is the 8-year-old, this summer spent a week at Sanford Winery in Santa Barbara working in the back with the winemakers and just getting him to, you know, and he took pictures and he's so proud that he has pictures in the wine tanks and doing things like that. And as you can see, I have some pictures around here of them tasting. They're allowed to taste an ounce of wine during dinner. So I'm not pushing them into it, but hopefully, you know, of the 100 longest families in business, 3 of them are winery owners. Antonori, Frescobaldi, and Ricazzoli. Ricazzoli started in 1143. Antonori in 1200 and Frescobaldi in 1206. Continuous generation of family in the business. We're in our, you know, my father, myself, my sons, and now my grandchildren. So we have 3. Why can that not be us? As a winemaker, that can happen. As a retailer, we don't know how wine is going to get to the consumer. As a distributor, we don't know how it's going to get to the stores. Maybe everything is going to be on internet. I'm not sure. But the vineyards and the winery can be there for 1,000 years, perhaps, just as the other 3 that I mentioned are there. And they're in the 32nd, 34th, 35th generation of a family running that winery. So it's possible. So we have 4 years. We have some time to go. And Antonori, you know, he still has, I know he's got at least another 2 generations that he's going to be able to manage with his family in it. And so is Frescobaldi and Ricazzoli.
It seems of all the businesses I've been aware of out there, it seems wine and family just go together hand in hand.
Yes, isn't that true?
Yeah.
It is. And that's not just in our family, you know, Italian families, but it's the same thing in France and some of the chateaus where there's been 10, 15 generations, Rothschilds, Chateau Lafite from the Segur family from 1700s, 1800s. And those families went on for maybe 200 years, 300 years.
So how do you see this? I mean, any concern about this being overdone, like anything else? I don't think this is a fad thing myself, but how do you see that?
You know, today wine is accepted. It's a culture now. In the 50s, when I was selling wine, the people that drank wine were people that traveled and the people that migrated to this country from other countries where wine was part of their everyday life, where they drank wine with their meals. Whereas my father, his wine that we drank and we would have in a water glass, we would have a little bit of wine. He would mix it with water. So I grew up with it. And when I got to high school with my friends, when we would go out, I would order wine and they would order pitchers of beer. And they would look at me rather strangely, you know, what are you drinking that sour stuff for? Because they used to call table wine sour. Sherry port, Muscatel, Angelica, white port were prevalent. And, you know, the story was older women would drink it before so they could sleep at night or something, have a little glass before they went to bed, something like that. But then now wine has become a culture. Successful people and business people go out to dinner, entertain, and they have wine courses for those people too. So when they're entertaining, they're able to order wine and have an understanding of it. Certainly in the 50s, no banking executive, just to use a bank executive, never thought about training their staff to be able to order a bottle of wine and be knowledgeable and show that he knew something about food and wine. But today, well, look what an example Top Chef is, which is just amazing. I just read an article that I did with somebody that I was with Fabio. I finished third. And we were walking into the Four Seasons, and there were four or five girls passing, you know, a little mini skirt, 25-year-old girls, and they said, "There's Fabio." You know, and they all circled around him, you know, and, "Oh, Fabio, you know, will you sign this for me?" You know, and they took pieces of paper out of there. And I said to my wife, I said, "You know, isn't this amazing? 25-year-old girls knowing somebody from Top Chef," because I had no idea of how important Top Chef is until now, that I find out that 3 or 4 million people watch that program. I went to, you know, for a test, yearly examination, nurse that I saw on Top Chef. Last night I went to Hole in the Wall restaurant. The two waitresses said, "I saw you on Top Chef." A woman that came in, to, you know, to be seated in the restaurant said, "You're the fellow that owns the wineries. I saw you on Top Chef." And it just, it absolutely amazes me, the people that are watching food shows today. So what is that a symbol of? What is that a symbol of? Where's the wine business going to be in the future? As long as gastronomy continues to grow, the wine grows with it, because wine follows gastronomy. If you're dining well and you're creating meals, or you're being very careful on how you create your meals, the beverage, what's the beverage? What's the ideal beverage to go with a well-prepared meal? Certainly a wine. And if you look in the United States today, Everest, 700 wines on the wine list. Charlie Trotter, 700 wines on his wine list. Why? Because they realize that there are people today that it's no more a red and a white. You know, I used to go to restaurants and I'd say, "Can I see the wine list?" They say, "We have a red and a white." I says, "Well, what brand?" He said, "We have a red and a white." Okay. And they would have to go in the back to see what the brand is. Today, they put a wine list in front of you, you know, and you've got 700 pages of wines to look at, 500 pages of wines. You know, Bordeaux's, Burgundy's, Australia, Chile, California, etc. So wine and food is growing. Gastronomy is certainly growing. The food shows clearly have indicated that. And wine is going to take its place along the way. And today, whereas when I went to college, it was a pitcher of beer. Okay, today, the kids get together, they put $10 a piece, and they order a $60 bottle of wine from the menu to have with their pizza. The pitcher of beer is still pitchers of beer being sold, of course, but when wine takes a more important sales position than beer, you could see what a long way it has come in the past 45 years. I'm very fortunate to have lived in this period to where all of this was happening, and I was able to take advantage of it.
So how did you come to be on Top Chef?
They asked us about 4 years ago if we would give a prize to one of the contestants. Maybe it was the third contestant, and we said, sure. And at that time, 3 or 4 years ago, honestly, I have to say, I didn't know very much about Top Chef. But my son said, sure, we will. So we gave a 6-liter bottle of one of our wines, Turlato Vineyards Angel's Peak, which is a Bordeaux blend, and a 3-day visit to Chimney Rock and Rutherford Hill. And when this Fabio Villani won, Susan said to me, "You are going to love this guy. You and him are going to get along so well. You perhaps might want to, you know, spend the 3 days out there with him, because he'd love to meet you, cook together." And so I met him, and she was absolutely right. I just enjoyed him so much. So we spent 3 days together. And this year they said, "We would like to do the finals of Top Chef in Napa Valley. Would you allow us to do it at Chimney Rock and Rutherford Hill?" We visited a number of wineries, and Rutherford Hill and Chimney Rock was on the list, and we realized they belonged to you. And so could we use it as the place for the finals? And we said, sure you can. So I picked the four wines that they had for the final dinner, and my son Billy was a judge in the finals. So we have a wonderful relationship. Bravo's a wonderful company to work with. We were with them from Monday to Friday till the finals. They shot, I can't tell you how many hours in the vineyards and in the wine, and then they cut this all down to 1 hour. It's fascinating how they're able to do it and still capture everything. We have a nice association with them. They're interested in fine dining, and we're interested in fine dining and fine wines that accompany fine dining. So it was very easy for us to communicate with each other. So, and like I said, they were very, very professional. We enjoyed working with them. So we were very fortunate to be the beneficiary, but we started with them early, and they were very nice to ask us to participate in the finals.
He's very cool, and he was one of the greatest characters they ever had on the show, because if there's one thing we talk about between food and wine, it's passion. And Fabio's like, in the encyclopedia, there's his picture.
So knowledgeable. He's a very passionate guy. You'll notice in his cookbook, there are no chicken recipes.
Really?
The reason there's no chicken recipes is because the chickens here and the chickens and the Florentine chickens where they grew right where he lived are different. And he says, you can't use this recipe with chickens from another country, not just the United States, but from Chile or from someplace. They said the recipes I did were from my hometown and where the chickens roamed, and you know, they're just different. And when I came here and I did chicken recipes, they didn't taste the same. And I realized that it wasn't me, it was the chicken. So there's no chicken recipes. I mean, that's how finite he is in paying attention. We've done zucchini flowers for years in my family. When he was here, we did zucchini flowers, and he just showed me another way to do them, and that's the way we're doing them now. For a boy, this is 32. He's so knowledgeable, but he's been cooking in the house and with his family since he's 10 years old. So he comes here with just an incredible amount of knowledge. Whatever you talk to him about, different meats and different vegetables and, you know, how he cooks his vegetables. And I remember Chef Joe Hossein, he measures a chef by how he cooks seasonally, what his food is like and how seasonally he cooks. So, you know, you go to a restaurant and you see pasta primavera in December, you know, you have to be very suspect. Pasta primavera is pasta in the spring, all right? And that's when the dish is supposed to be done, because that's when the herbs are at their best. So, but it takes a Paul Bartolotto or Fabio or, you know, a number of the other chefs, Charlie Trotter, to have an understanding about seasonality of food and when you should be doing broccoli and when you should be doing each one of these different dishes. You can do white truffle right now, okay? You're not going to do white truffle in June, because white truffles are October, November, and December.
But also, too, for me, I see sort of the tip of the hat of these new shows like Top Chef and these others to the days of, obviously, Julia Child and certainly Graham Kerr, who I grew up watching that show.
Yes.
And I remember the glass of wine was with him all the time.
Yes.
And there was a little seed planted back then.
I did a dinner for Julia Child where we honored her. I gave her a Baccarat decanter for wine. Her pictures around her shoes was just wonderful. Just wonderful to be with. When she had her show many years ago, you know, I watched it and I wasn't really paying a lot of attention. But I realized how important she was as my life in wine progressed. I realized what she and Robert Mondavi did together in Napa when they put food and wines together and the arts and so on, that wine and food has become an art. I mean, it's not like a painting or a violinist or a pianist, but it is an art form, and is it going to continue to be, I believe. Chefs today are celebrities. It's interesting talking to them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, about how they frame a dinner. You don't do high C with your appetizer, you know? Gastronomy is like a symphony. You start here and you build up to high C, all right? And high C is your entree. So you don't want to have the greatest appetizer, the greatest first, greatest second. You want to build like Beethoven would build, you know, to the crescendo, or that Caruso would build to high C in an aria. You don't start, well, Aida starts with high C, but it's one of the few. But usually the high C's, you know, come towards the end. Puccini puts them at the end. We covered family, we covered, you know, wine, we covered gastronomy. We love our work. People in the building, we have a nice facility to work in, which is, you know, very similar to some of the ancient, I don't want to call them castles, but yeah, well, they are chateaus of sorts. So when Philippe de Rothschild comes here, she knows what a chateau is, and she knows what a Tudor Gothic, special Tudor Gothic building is. So I guess this is a symbol of the way we look at a wine business. This is part of it. The dining room, the kitchen, designed by Chef Joho, and all the things that this building replicates. It's a Tudor Gothic. It's one of the best, one of the most important. It took 16 years to build. They started in 1916, and they moved in 1932. Imagine waiting 16 years. I mean, there's a lot of people waiting 16 years now, but they can't help it, right? Because the carpenter doesn't show up,
yeah, exactly.
Or the plumber. But yeah. I mean, they would be on a vessel. They would go to Europe. They would bring back different different pieces, floors, woodworks, fireplaces. Of course, there was no planes. They had to go by boat. So it was, you know, maybe 30 days across the ocean, 30 days come back. So imagine taking your architect with you and then spending 2 months in Italy and mostly in France and in England buying these old furnitures to bring into this Tudor Gothic building. They built a little house across the street, and they watched this go up for 16 years before they moved in. It's fascinating, isn't it?
It's a very different place.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, today, if the carpenter doesn't show up tomorrow, you're on the phone, you know, hollering at him.
How's it even possible to think of something like this
today?
It's an extraordinary...
16 years.
Extraordinary.
Well, 26,000 square feet, and I don't know, is it 27 rooms, I think?
Tony, I can't thank you enough for taking the time today on this snowy morning and talking with Life Between the Vines.
Well, this is a pleasure, and thank you for including me in your program. I appreciate it.
You can visit the Wines of Terlato International on the web at terlatowines.com.